Story 4. Learning Delta Pride.
Here's another thought that stops people. There are a lot of possibilities that sound exciting, but you're not sure you'd want to do them forever. And because of their quirky nature, they're resume killers that slam a lot of doors shut. Sure, it'd be a fun ride, but where do you go from there? Well, imagine you were a Harvard MBA and then an investment banker with First Boston at the vice president level. At that point, if you had the guts, you could jump to just about anywhere white-collar and respectable, or you could stay put and get rich. Instead, imagine you went off and did something crazy, which resulted in this entry at the top of your resume. 1990 to present. Catfish farmer, Indianola, Mississippi. Managed 8,000 acres of grow crops and 1,500 water acres of catfish, 5.5 million head of catfish, $16 million in annual sales. Side businesses, wholly or partially owned, include cotton gin, flying service for pesticide spraying, feed mill, fish processing plant, and adult extended care facility. That's what the top of Don Lin's resume looks like, and that's about all I knew of his story when I went to see him. But my curiosity was raging. What would his life be like? Would the foolish originality of this path be worth its stubborn irreversibility? Was it indeed a one-way ticket? Could daily life in the third poorest county in the poorest state in the Union possibly be interesting enough to keep his Ivy League mind engaged? To get to Indianola, you fly to Memphis, drive down past Graceland, and keep going in that direction for half a day. Once you get to Indianola, to find Don Lin's office, take a right at the four-way stop sign, and then take a left where the church used to be, and it'll be a quarter mile ahead. Where the church used to be? How would I know where the church used to be? But that's the way you get directions in the Mid-South. Don grew up in South Carolina and Tennessee, and then spent the go-go 80s in Dallas, but a southern accent ain't the beginning of how they talk here. You never say it rained. You might say, "We got ourselves a little private rain, inch and a tenth," or "It was a real packin' rain," meaning the clay soil glued itself into a crust that the cotton sprouts have a hard time busting through, or if the rain was heavy, you'd say, "We done got thundered on." When the catfish tastes good, it's on flavor. The foreman is called the straw boss, and if he's off drinking, you're told he got the jack attack. And when you go looking for him and run into one of the farmhands, the conversation might transact like this. "How you been?" "I've been good." "Where you been?" "I've been around." "So when you figure he'd be around then?" "He'd be here 10 minutes or so."
11,000 people live here. Unemployment is 12%. Bad, but not that bad. Cash advance shops outnumber bank branches. A trenchant crack problem plagues the neighborhood on the other side of the railroad tracks. You can't get any men to work during bow hunting season. And conversations focus on hunting, football, and who's screwing who. The local weekly newspaper lists every traffic fine and charge brought by the local police. Most of the jobs listed are for drivers. A truck driver takes home $8.50 an hour, the women at the catfish processing plant a little less, and the seining crew, which dredges the catfish ponds, earns a minimum wage. A straw boss earns anywhere from $40,000 to $100,000. Don gets up at 4 a.m. every morning to read. Almost every day, a shipment arrives from Amazon.com with more brain food. Don misses New England's intellectual culture, but he's insistent on one point, which took him a year to wake up to. It'd be easy to mistake these people's ways for lack of intelligence, but most of them are as smart as you and me. They've never been out in the world. Some are uneducated, but they know their business better than I know mine. This part of the state doesn't have a long history. It was swamp and bayou until the levees were constructed along the Mississippi in the 1920s. The hardwood forests of mangrove, pecan, and walnut were cleared to get rid of mosquitoes and stop the spread of malaria. The drained land was so heavy with clay they named it gumbo. It wouldn't seep. Only the old high spots could grow corn, so with the rest they farmed rice, but farming rice is prohibitively expensive. 2 decades ago, someone dug a 5-foot pond in the gumbo and tried raising catfish. This made a certain economic sense. Catfish are nature's most efficient animal in turning feed into protein, twice as efficient as a chicken, for instance. Catfish are the hogs of aquaculture. They'll eat anything. Fish pick up their flavor from their environment. Catfish acquire their legendary aroma by scarfing off the bottom where fish rot. A decade ago, someone started feeding catfish a puffed cereal that had been aerated and thus floated on the water's surface. The fillets from young catfish that eat off the water's surface are as flaky and light as any freshwater whitefish. It used to take 3 days to net a fish, truck it to the plant, get it filleted and frozen. Now it takes 30 minutes. Boom! The catfish industry exploded, and this part of the country finally had the means to sustain itself and reason to be proud. That's about when Don arrived. He's 6 feet even, thick sideswept auburn hair, too pink skin for these parts, and has let his gut go a little. He hasn't changed much what he wears, pleated khakis, pink polo shirts, deck shoes. Don's here as a businessman. His wife talks a lot about a sense of place, and if you enjoy being close to nature, rolling the sleeves up, there's psychic income galore here. But Don isn't one of those people. He didn't come to Mississippi with a sentiment that farming was a particularly noble business. Back in Dallas, he didn't own a cabin out in Lake Country. He carries a rifle in case he encounters a water moccasin, but that's all it's used for. The adrenaline he gets, that charge that makes it all worthwhile, comes entirely from the risks and rewards of running a big, complex business. His first day on the job, a flock of Canadian geese arrived by truck. That sounds weird, I know, but the geese had been purchased with the intent that they'd populate the bayou that ran through their land. The geese were thrown into a cabin and had their way with the place. Don had to go in there with pruning shears and clip their wings. Quickly covered in goose shit and blood, Don was wondering what he'd got himself into. A few nights later, the phone rang at 2 a.m. Don couldn't sleep anyway, it was so hot. The voice said, "Get on out to the ponds." Don drove out to the ponds, each of which is about the size of a football field. There was a froth on the water. Something had driven those fish crazy, and a lot of them were turning belly up. "They can't breathe," Don was told. "They're coming to the surface to get a gulp of air." Why would fish be breathing air? It didn't make any sense. Slowly, Don figured it out. There's 10,000 head of fish to every acre, unbelievably thick with fish, and they're burning oxygen to digest their food. During the day, sunlight triggers photosynthesis in the algae, keeping the water oxygenated. On a hot night, with the water evaporating, the oxygen runs out. Don put a paddle wheel on the water to stir air into it, but it was too late. For the next month, Don rode around the ponds at night, monitoring the oxygen levels with a measuring stick on a long pole, trying to keep his fish alive by allocating paddle wheels where the situation was desperate. Don found that other farmers wouldn't return his phone calls. He wondered if he'd done something to insult them. Then he found out that it was insulting to use the phone. They liked to chat in person, down at the cafe or by the side of the road. I make it sound like his MBA ain't worth a lick here, and I don't mean to. Farming is a famously tough business. It's as risky as biotech, and it pays out no better than T-bills. That's including the aid income from the government, which is more than half of the total income on most farms. The difference between making 2% profit a year and losing your shirt is in maximizing the efficiency of resources. Catfish fingerlings cost 5 cents per, and by the time a fish is big enough to harvest with 12 ounces of meat on its bones, Don has spent 55 cents on every fish. He sells them for about 70 cents a pound. You can't harvest the fish when it's too hot, or they won't be on flavor. If the fish get too big while they're waiting for their flavor to clean out, they become too tough. Grow crops are even more weather-dependent. Corn goes in mid-March, then some early soybeans. Wait for another cold snap, then plant the cotton. It costs $325 to raise and pick an acre of cotton. Most of that money used to go into pesticides, but now there's worm-resistant seed, which can get by with little pesticide, except the seed is expensive, which means Don's bet is already in the ground. If the sprouts get hailed on or can't get a stand through the crust, he loses his bet. Last summer, it was so hot that Don's plants couldn't pollinate. Back at his office, Don has computer programs generating wall charts that map out every penny spent on every acre. He spends 2 hours every day watching the commodities exchanges and hedging his risk by buying or selling in the futures market. In the language of an MBA, it's a classic resource optimization problem. In the language of a farmer, it's just life. Late in his first year, Don earned the respect of the other farmers in the valley. Five big farms share ownership in a catfish processing cooperative, Delta Pride. Don got a call at midnight from the co-op's bookkeeper. The bookkeeper had been ordered by two executives to make fictional entries inflating sales. On behalf of the co-op, Don went in the next morning and fired them on the spot. He discovered the co-op was in bad financial shape. None of the farms could afford to lose their investment. Don decided to step in and run it himself for a year. He nursed the business back to strength and won over the locals. He saved a couple hundred jobs. The next year, Don learned that good people were having to leave Indianola for Jackson, where they could get care for their elderly parents. So Don created an elder care facility, sort of like daycare for parents. It was so successful, he now has three centers. Don's dedication and resourcefulness have paid off. Despite the deteriorating agricultural economy countrywide, Don's business has grown at rates even his business school mates would admire. Revenue has tripled, and profits have quadrupled. I rode with Don on his rounds. He's calm and thoughtful. Nothing I asked him caught him off guard or forced him to contemplate something he hasn't already considered on his own. That said, he was hungry to talk with me and to show me the good and bad of his life. He didn't leave anything out. Most of Don's days are spent shuttling about in his Suburban, making sure everything's getting done. The rule of thumb for farming is, go wherever you're spending or making the most money at the moment. This morning, a seining crew was harvesting the catfish in Pond 9. They'd stretched a huge net across the water, dragging each end with a tractor. Two men in chest waders walked along the pond bottom, 1 foot on the net to keep it from floating to the surface. Don doesn't have to say too much. His presence is a motivator. If his hires don't think they're being monitored, they'll slack off. That's the work culture here, so that's the essential nature of Don's role, and it's hard for that not to have its erosive effect. He has to be slightly watchful just about all the time. Don didn't learn this lesson quickly, and it's not in his basic nature. On Wall Street, everybody's income was tied to their performance, and that was all the motivation anyone needed. Supervision was nil. So when Don came to Mississippi, he tried to vest his employees with back-end incentives and empower them with autonomy, etc., but the traditional culture was too entrenched to overcome. I asked Don why he left First Boston.
I started out at Payne Webber. We were drilled and drilled that if we gave good advice, we'd get business. Clients would come to us. And I was so successful doing that in Boston that the firm asked me to run the Dallas office. This was 1987, the height of the fever. Investment banking changed. It became predatory. 6 months into it, First Boston made me an offer to move my team over to their firm. They were more prestigious, so I went ahead.
The way investment banking works, every couple years, someone invents a new kind of financing deal. If it flies and everyone makes money, they reproduce this deal on every other company they can sell it to, whether it fits them or not. In the late 1990s, this deal was the IPO, the initial public offering. A few dynamic startups went public and became huge successes, so banks jumped in and took a couple hundred other startups public, even though few were worthy. In the mid-80s, the equivalent deal was the LBO, the leveraged buyout. First Boston performed a headline-grabbing multi-billion dollar leveraged buyout for Federated Stores and earned huge fees in the process. In the following 2 years, First Boston ordered all of its corporate financiers to sell look-alike deals to their clients. That's the nature of the beast. It's no different than Hollywood cranking out the Matrix sequels or the record industry churning out boy bands. I know this because at the time, I was an assistant bond salesman at First Boston. I sold the Federated Stores debt and everything else behind it.
So you understand this then, Don said. And I said, I think I was too young to understand it at the time. But since then, in seeing the pattern repeated with IPOs, I slowly realized how the business works. Well, I was old enough to know I didn't want to do business that way, and I told my bosses as much. I told them I'd only generate business I was comfortable with. I became passive-aggressive, dragging my feet, not calling my clients. Then I had one particular client, and I was ordered to push an LBO on him. I knew the numbers wouldn't work. If he did the deal, he'd never be able to pay off the bonds, but we were supposed to be long gone by then. I was embarrassed to put together the proposal. That night, I thought hard about it. I knew I couldn't do it. My father was a high school principal. My role model was a professor of finance at Vanderbilt. They never compromised their ethics. So what'd you do? I asked. Well, around this same time, my baby boy was walking but not yet talking. He'd entered that phase when he was developing separation anxiety. Part of that is he'd cry if he was ever picked up by strangers. And you remember how it was. I was gone 5 or 6 days a week. I was flying to New York twice a week. All week I'd stare at his picture, and I loved him so much it practically made me cry with joy to think about him. He was becoming a little person. All week long, I wanted nothing more than to be able to come home and hold him, pick him up in my arms and play with him.
And he didn't recognize you?
I was a stranger. He'd cry if his mother walked out of the room, but he'd cry if I walked in the room. That was when it finally hit me. No more.
Don's story fit the same pattern as others I'd talked to. Unethical business alone wasn't enough to impel a change. It had to get personal. For me, churning billable hours didn't get me to quit. It was realizing how much weight I'd lost. If you need to summon the will to make a change, don't debate ethics. Get personal. If you don't believe in the integrity of your profession, you can debate the ethics of it forever and never do anything. But if you define the personal toll it's taking, it hits a lot closer to home. So did you quit? I asked. I had memories of bankers who quit or were fired. They were ushered from the building by security guards in minutes. Not exactly. I came to an agreement with the firm that after the bonus cycle, I wouldn't re-up for another round. I had about 30 days to figure out what to do next.
You didn't have any savings?
Well, I had some, but with a mortgage and 2 kids. He wasn't going to let himself hang out for months waiting for a vision.
So of all the things you could have done, how in the world, Don, did you end up a catfish farmer? Particularly if you didn't think it was noble and you weren't an outdoorsman itching to get back to the land.
It wasn't like I chose catfish farmer off a long list of possibilities. It was the only opportunity that presented itself.
Since the Depression, this farm had been passed down in his wife's family, but her generation had run for the cities and wanted nothing to do with farming. If they couldn't find someone to manage the operation, the family would have to sell the land. And during this 30-day period, Don's father-in-law paid them a visit, described his problem, and Don, who'd never in his wildest dreams considered something like this, volunteered for the job. It wasn't a well-analyzed decision. He saw an out, and he thought it would be good for his kids to run in trees and fields and sky.
"Weren't you afraid?" I asked.
"I sure was."
"Of?"
"Of how it would look. Not then, but later. I was aware it looked like a step down to my old business school classmates. Would anyone ever hire me after I'd done this crazy thing? I didn't think so. This would be it, the last stop. I expected to be buried in the backyard." He meant this literally. There was a burial plot behind the house.
Was that feeling of being able to see the rest of your life, knowing it wouldn't change much, was that comfortable or uncomfortable?
Both.
Farming may be just a business to Don, but it's had a different effect on him from investment banking, just as the catfish changed when it started feeding from cleaner water. Success here doesn't come at someone else's expense. Don isn't trying to steal another farm's business. He can't outbid them or charge more than the market will bear, and there's no chance for excessive profits. It encourages him to be steady, to take it slow, and to ride out the crises. I took the chance to bring up the irreversibility question. Was he going to do this forever? Did he even have a choice? He said,
Those soybeans we watched going in, those are the last soybeans we'll ever plant. What are you going to grow instead? Nothing. We're selling the farm.
Why? You can't make any money?
No, we're doing fine. We've had some tough years, but the farm's well capitalized. The family wants their money out.
If his wife's older relatives died, the estate tax would be triggered, and the next generation would have to cough up far more cash than they had.
My job's up in September, he added.
This was a bit of a shock. I'd only been there 2 days, but I could tell I'd have memories of this place forever.
Why don't you buy it? I asked.
Can't afford it.
How long have you known?
Since the end of last season.
How's it make you feel?
Scared of the uncertainty.
I bet.
I'll be all right, though.
What are you thinking of doing?
Well, I would have thought that nobody in the world wants to hire a former banker turned farmer. But as it turns out, I've become a bit of an expert on transgenic foodstuffs. I've seen firsthand the good it can do. I put us into a program for experimental farms. The summer nights here were too hot to grow corn until Monsanto invented a strain for the Mid-South. Our seeds are engineered to be worm-resistant. Some aren't genetic hybrids. They have one gene scratched out. There's a new catfish cereal that has a fish meal protein mixed in, though we've held back on using that yet. I've been reading all the research as these and other products came to market. So it's a little premature. I haven't been hired yet. But there's some biotech startups who are interested in the diversity of my background. I'm talking to headhunters and flying out for interviews.
Wow.
Yeah.
Who would have thought that taking such a crazy leap would turn out to be the perfect stepping stone to get in on the next new thing?
Not me.
What part of the country?
Big cities. Bay Area, Boston, Maryland, Research Triangle.
Intellectual havens.
Yup, and I won't be swatting mosquitoes in November.
I was really heartened to know it was going to work out for Don, that this wasn't irreversible, and we talked about it a lot. As he said, you close one door behind you, and inevitably another one opens up in front. In these startups, they need a business manager who understands what farmers want and why they're wary of newfangled products. It's a lot easier to imagine them buying seeds from Don, who's walked in their shoes, than from some bioengineer who's never set foot on a farm. In fact, when we get back to the office, Don has a phoner with a headhunter. Don's done more than read the research. He's flown to meet with many of the researchers in person for his own education. He visited a lab in Boston where they were splicing salmon genes into catfish DNA, with the hopes their super catfish would get the magical ice water gene. Don told me this upcoming passage felt different from the one he made a decade ago. He's not trying to play it down, minimize the change it will surely bring.
Transition's not the right word. It'll require a transformation.
Last October, he went to a continuing education retreat at Harvard, taught by a sociology professor named Shoshana Zuboff. Her course was called Odyssey, and it was mostly attended by business people looking for the next thing in life. She had Don write his autobiography, then helped him expand on it, write more and more into it, picking out themes, adding layers. She built her course around the metaphor of an oyster shell. The outside layer, the formative layer, is fragile and vulnerable, but the old layers are hard and strong. Don figures he's got enough layers on him now to hold out no matter how hard it gets in the next year. He's looking forward to not merely changing hats, but changing heads. Did you ever hear businessmen brag about all the hats they wore? As if wearing the hat were enough, rather than the whole uniform, or more, embodying the whole point of view. At some point, we have to give up the habit of measuring ourselves against our peers. Don did that long ago. But to prepare for this upcoming passage, he's been tracking down his old friends and reestablishing contact. Ironically, his life compares well. Most of Don's classmates who chose investment banking because it would be a bridge to some other yet unknown destination never ended up crossing the bridge. They were trained to be bankers, they got good at it, and they never left its domain. Most have turned out to be sad guys with gray lives, bankers at accounting firms, brokers at Schwab, earning half what they did a decade ago. The good times couldn't last forever. And Don's come to think the strategy of keeping your doors open is mostly an illusion or a trap.
A month after my visit, I called for Don to find out if his conversations with that headhunter had led to a job yet, and if he might be coming to San Francisco to interview.
"Oh, he's not here," Don's secretary said.
"When will he be back?"
"Well, he went out into the country to set a pile of stumps on fire."
"Hmm, how long you figure that could take?"
"Could be right quick, but if those stumps are slow to catch, he could be a while."
"Well, you tell him I said hi."
"I sure will."
Don emailed me that night. He'd come upon the final words Raymond Carver ever wrote, which spoke to him mightily. "And did you get what you wanted from this life, even so? I did." That was classic Don Lynn, yin-yanging between piles of stumps by day, Raymond Carver's verse by night.
Story 5. A billion is chump change.
There's a part of my story I can't make sense of. I loved selling bonds. I was a sales assistant, meaning I sold on behalf of my two bosses to their clients, mostly banks and savings and loans. I sat right between both of them, clearing their trades, hearing every whisper of every call, missing nothing, and handling everything they didn't have time for. Their clients learned to trust me. My math gift made it easy to find the story in a pattern of numbers, spot anomalies, and exploit them. As a budding writer, I enjoyed translating that story into words, lending it a bit of drama, making the pitch zing. It was clear to all I had a rare talent for the markets, and when I was 24, after I'd been on the mortgage desk for 18 months, the firm offered me a position as full salesman with projected first-year commissions of a whopping $300,000. The two guys I worked for earned 2 to 4 times this amount, so I knew it was no joke. I could reach their level within a few years. But for some reason, I turned the firm down and walked away with nothing. I didn't say no right away. I wasn't good at saying no to anybody's face. So I said, "That sounded good. Can we talk about it later?" And I'd go home with my stomach in knots, dreading having to make a decision. The firm kept bringing it up, and I strung them along for a couple months until they finally realized I wasn't biting. My ability to understand how I resisted that temptation only gets foggier over time. How could I be so stupid? It wasn't my dream, but so what? Why not do it for a couple years and sock away a nest egg? I honestly don't know. I probably had a handful of reasons at the time, but in retrospect, none outweigh the reasons to have $500,000 in my savings account. I'm too embarrassed to tell you my reasons, for it will clearly reveal I am perhaps the stupidest person of all time. Even though it worked out, and anyone would say I made the right decision, I still second-guess it. I was drawn to the sales floor from the moment I walked the edge of its trenches. A friend had passed around my resume, and I was called in for an interview. I didn't know what the job was. It didn't matter. I was already sold. Men and women were running around, hollering at each other, gesturing with their arms, cracking jokes. Their sleeves were rolled up and their ties loosened, and they were eating at their desks or throwing phones or barking into the squawk box. They called each other by nicknames: Q, Mayo, Doll, Dano, Crash. I didn't know what a bond was, or the difference between a bid and an offer, but coming from that suffocating, windowless room at the litigation firm, this looked like a blast. It had an egalitarian ethic. Titles meant nothing, and management was thin to none. The gig paid about $35,000 a year. I should have bargained for more. They probably wanted me to counter, but I would have hung out on that sales floor for less. I thrived in that environment. It was so loose, so unpoliced, that I felt incredibly free to be myself. After a year, the firm brought in a distinguished elderly Chinese gentleman, Mr. Bob Chang, to cover the pipeline of high-net-worth investors moving to the States from Hong Kong. The firm warned me to rein in my eccentricity around Mr. Chang, be a little more proper, Bronson. But in 2 weeks, I had Mr. Chang standing on an imaginary pitching mound in the middle of the sales floor, throwing fastballs of wadded paper down the aisle into my catcher's glove. During peak trading hours, nobody said a word to me about it. As long as Mr. Chang was happy, I was untouchable. This was in San Francisco, not New York, so we had to be at the office by 5 a.m.
It was punishing to drag myself down there at that wee hour when the streets were empty and the sky was dark. But in some way, this added to its luster. I wasn't one of those faceless drones who filled the sidewalks at 8:56 every morning, hurrying to clock in my FaceTime. I didn't feel so anonymous, so indistinguishable, so unnoticed by the eye of history. But after 18 months, I was itching for a new environment. And I'm not good at not scratching my itches. That environment had taught me what it could. Example 1. I went in there with a terrible fear of picking up the phone. I was the kind of guy who put off for a week calling the hardware store to see if they carried a certain brand of paint. Calling people for job interviews was way out of my league. But my desk at First Boston had over 200 direct phone lines to the firm's accounts, all at a push of a button, and on an average day I would have to make or answer a couple hundred phone calls to pitch a trade or quote a price or confirm a settlement. I had to make those calls or I was fired. It pushed me. I got over my fear. Gone forever. Example 2. I learned an attitude, a cavalierness around money. How to show no fear and keep my wits when the sums get big. From the first day, I had nearly $1 billion a day pass through my hands. Does that sound like a lot? It sure did to me. The first time I processed a trade for $300 million, I could barely stand. I was so afraid I'd somehow screw it up. But anybody who's worked in the debt markets knows that a $300 million trade in overnight repos is actually meaningless slop. It's a doggy bag, scraps left over from whatever the banks didn't get properly invested that day. The commissions on it are barely enough to buy a shoe shine and a taxi ride home. $1 billion a day is chump change if it's only one day at a time. So it's that kind of attitude I learned, that $1 billion can be mere chump change, nothing to get impressed about. Nobody ever taught me this directly or said it aloud. It was the flavor of the room, and like a catfish, I soaked it up. I carry that attitude with me to this day. I'm so easily unimpressed by the dollar signs. So maybe that's why I didn't stay 2 more years. Maybe the environment made me immune to its temptations. It vaccinated me. The firm offered me $300 grand, and I was callous about it. 300 isn't really that much money, I would say. It's not enough to retire on. It's enough to get habit forming, and that's a pretty expensive habit. It was like play money, monopoly money. What would I possibly need that money for? "Well, money is freedom," my dad said. "I'm already free," I shot back. "It's a different kind of freedom that you'll learn to appreciate later in life. Then I'll deal with it then." That makes it sound like my dad was some paternal quote generator, but in fact, he'd recently rebuilt his life after putting his company through bankruptcy. He knew the feeling of independence one has when making money, and he knew, way too intimately, the loss of control one feels under insurmountable debt. He learned it the hard way. But I ignored that, and wrote off his words as typical Mr. Cleaver dad stuff. I had no idea how to listen. I couldn't take it seriously. If I was financially independent, I would never have to take work I didn't want to do. But to become financially independent, I had to take work I didn't want to do. 2 years would lead to 5 years, and then I'd be like one of Don Lynn's old friends. Why waste years trying to game the system? Why fabricate excuses for why I should stick at a job that wasn't ultimately the real me? There had to be a more straightforward way. Maybe what follows is too neat of an answer, too virtuous to be real. I was obsessed with these identity questions. Who am I? Why am I here? And I wanted to pursue this quest. But I was surrounded by men and women who showed no interest in that question. They were trying to score big and cash out. They were a few more good years away from never having to worry about money again. I might have stayed if one of them had put his arm around my shoulder and said, "This is my calling. This is my natural environment. Let me tell you how I'm making a life out of it." If I needed role models, I'd have to look elsewhere. Oddly, they are all still in the business 13 years later, all but two at different firms. Some are rich, some aren't, but none left the life behind. They learned that having been at one of the best firms on Wall Street is a currency. It means something, but it only means something on Wall Street. Take that title off Wall Street, and it gets devalued fast. You can't trade it into a position in other industries and make anywhere near the kind of money. Wall Street teaches that money is the only unbiased and objective measure of a person. Trading out of the business is a stupid trade that few make. Failure's hard, but success is more dangerous. If you're successful at the wrong thing, the mix of praise and money and opportunity can lock you in forever. It is so, so much harder to leave a good thing.
Story 6. The Crossroads of Temptation.
How many times do you really face a choice in life? How many times will you get the benefit of arriving at a crossroads where you don't have to fight the tug of rolling inertia and your choice isn't going to hurt someone you love? Not many. Make them count. They will define you. When I left First Boston, I joined my girlfriend managing and writing a subscription-only newsletter on San Francisco politics. I was earning about $1,000 a month. At night, I took my first class in creative writing at San Francisco State, a lonely commuter school of mostly part-time students. I continued to wedge one class a week into my schedule for the next 7 years. You might think that I had an obvious topic to write about, bringing to school my incredible front-row perspective on the unique macho culture of global finance. But I went 5 years before it even occurred to me I could use that setting in fiction. That wasn't what serious fiction writers wrote about, and I wanted to impress my teachers. The writers and books they held up as role models didn't go near the workplace. Minimalism was in vogue. Nobody wanted to read about the jobs we so wanted to escape from. Writing school was a window to leave that dull numbness behind. We were encouraged to find our material in our childhood and in our family heritage and in our travels abroad and in our rocky love lives. My writing was decent, but it was severely handicapped by lack of material because I didn't have a rocky love life and had never traveled anywhere. I eked out some stories that later made it into anthologies and literary journals, but the going was slow. I didn't know it was slow at the time. I thought that was the deal. Years passed. I'd reached the upper-level MFA workshops, and I had a story due in 2 days. I had nothing to turn in. I didn't have anything to write about because I'd spent my entire adult life hauling my ass off to one job after another. With deadline looming, I stubbornly decided I would write about that, about hauling my ass off to work at 4 a.m. Something magical happened. I wrote a story in about 12 hours. I didn't need sleep, and it wasn't a straightforward confessional memoir story. It incorporated for the first time the wilder writing styles I loved, magical realism, absurdism, satire. These were forms that, until then, I'd never been able to control. But I found my voice in a topic I finally had something to say about. When I submitted it to workshop, I was dead certain everybody would hate it and find it inappropriate. It was everything serious writing wasn't supposed to be. Funny, bloated with overwritten sentences, and set entirely on the bond sales floor. These deficiencies were pointed out to me in class, but in the hallways later, classmates admitted they liked it anyway. It was different in a good way, they said. The next few months presented me with the biggest crossroads of my writing career. This is the pattern of my life, both professional and personal. Every time I'm about to follow my heart, I am offered an enormous temptation. At this point, I'd been a graduate student for 5 years and dreamed of nothing but getting a collection of my short stories published. I'd been talking frequently to my friend's agent, and she agreed to represent me when I had enough stories together. I sent her this new story I was so proud of, and she never got back to me. No matter, because one of my earlier stories that had been published in a literary journal made it into the hands of an editor at a new imprint, Harper SF. He took me out for lunch at Zuni Cafe and intimated he wanted to publish my stories as soon as he got his imprint's budget authorized by the parent conglomerate. With great excitement, I presented this new story on top of my others, and 2 weeks later, he told me he loved them all except this new one. I was confused how to handle it. Publishers had been rejecting my stories for 8 years. Finally, one was interested, but not in the writing I was most jazzed by. "I'm still waiting on my budget," he said. "Hang in there. It won't be much money, but we'll get it done soon." "I'd still like to include this story," I said. "We'll talk about it," he said, meaning not likely. A couple nights later, I ran into that agent, my friend's agent, at a party. I cornered her and asked what she thought of that new story I sent her. "I didn't get it," she said.
"You didn't receive it?"
"No, I received it and I read it, but I didn't get it. I didn't understand it. I wasn't engaged." "Really? I was so excited about it. I was thinking of making it into a novel." Seeing I was on the verge of making a big mistake, she tried to set me right. "It was one of the least interesting stories you've sent me," she said. I did want to make it into a novel. I'd scratched the surface with that story, and I thought I could do a lot with the premise. My plan was to work on the novel while the short stories were getting published, but nobody else liked that plan. I sent the story to two other notable writers whose advice and encouragement thus far had been invaluable to me. I hung on their every word. They saw merits in the story, but didn't think I should go in that direction. I think back, and I'm so grateful the promised contract for the short stories never arrived. He never resolved his budget fight, and a different editor took over the imprint. I'd resisted the temptation of a $300,000 a year salary, but I don't think I was strong enough to resist having those stories I'd slaved over for 5 years get published. The minor ensuing praise would have locked me into that track forever. My writing would have gone in a different direction, but a well-traveled one. Everybody I respected told me to drop the novel, but I couldn't. All I had to go on was my memory of those magical 12 hours in which writing was no longer so painful, no longer so exhausting, no longer insubstantial. Would it happen again the next time I sat down to write? There was only one way to find out. So I found a new agent, and with his encouragement, I set to work on the novel. I anticipated the writing would take a couple years. I was done in 4 months. That magical thing kept happening. My agent sent the novel to one editor he believed would like it. He read it that night and bought it the next day. Then the Brits bought it, and the Germans, and the Japanese, and the Koreans, the Russians, the Italians, the Greeks, the Danes, Dutch, Spaniards, Portuguese, and Chinese. The success I've enjoyed since then has never resolved this underlying shame I carry that I've been writing books about topics that serious writers don't touch. I have never quite gotten over that stigma. Most of my fan mail begins, "Dear Poe, I never thought I'd want to read a book set in the business world, but I was at the bookstore and read a few pages, and the next thing you know, I'm writing you." But that's the material life dealt me. And I was never going to be successful until I accepted it and worked with it. Let me bring this full circle. I found that a lot of people have the same stigma about the "what should I do with my life" question as I had writing a novel about bond salesmen. They fear it's not a serious question because it's mostly about the job, not the heart, not character, not love, not issues that matter. But it is about those things. That's what I hope these stories reveal. What Should I Do With My Life is the modern, secular version of the great timeless questions about our identity, such as who am I and where do I belong? We ask it in this new way simply because constant disruption in our society forces us to, every time we graduate or get downsized or move to a new city, we're confronted with this version of the question. It's a little more pragmatic than its philosophical and religious antecedents, reflecting the bottom-line reality that we can search for our identity only so long without making ends meet. Asking the question aspires to end the conflict between who you are and what you do. Answering the question is the way to protect yourself from being lathed into someone you're not.
Story 7. The Lockbox Fantasy.
Couldn't I have published those short stories, then published the novel? Couldn't I have spent 2 more years at First Boston, then gone to writing school? Why not get rich, then do your dream? When I started writing the book that gave rise to this program, I assumed I'd find numerous examples of that path. Surely, among all the young millionaires who left Wall Street or Silicon Valley, I'd find some who used their money to bankroll a successful run at the dream they always harbored. But I didn't find any. I found tons of rich guys who were now giving away a lot to charity, or who were traveling the world on a big yacht. I found plenty who only discovered their purpose after they made some money. Plenty who always wanted to own an island, and now they do, or who always wanted to own a plane, and now they do. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the garden variety fantasy. Put your dream in a lockbox, go out and make fuck you money, then come back to the lockbox and pick up where you left off. I met plenty who tried, but none who succeeded. I found Wall Streeters who went off to the finest art schools but never made a splash. I found dot-comers who went down to Hollywood to write movies but never met with success. I'm sure they're out there, but compared with how prevalent the fantasy is, examples of the strategy succeeding should be easier to find, shouldn't they? Particularly for someone like me, since I know thousands of people who got rich in those industries. Okay, so what about Mark Cuban, who made $3 billion in the internet, then bought the Dallas Mavericks? Well, he doesn't count. He didn't put his dream in a lockbox. He loved sports, so he built a sports radio site to listen to his beloved Chicago Cubs games, and the next thing he knew, he had $3 billion. He followed his passion. He didn't lock it away. I've seen lots of people get rich. It takes twice as long as anyone plans for. It's more work than anyone expects. It requires more sacrifices, more changes. You don't come away from that the same person who went in. And you end up so emotionally invested in that world and psychologically adapted to that world that you don't really want to ditch it, take the money and run. In the battle to succeed, you develop a respect for its difficulty. You adopt values, and even though you might have plenty of money to pump into, say, a nightclub, you can't get pride out of owning a money loser. I met some rich guys who then bought nightclubs, but they sold them. I know lots more guys who invested in nightclubs. It's just a cool thing in their portfolio. Let me describe the kind of person I was much more likely to meet. I met people like this in droves. I didn't go looking for them. They came to me. They were 28 or 35 or 46 or 52, and they'd gotten accustomed to making very good bank. Filthy rich? No. But did they have enough money to quit and change their life? Sure. They wanted to. 10 times a day, they'd fantasize about doing it. But they couldn't seem to cut off that pipeline of cash. They'd come to me because they'd heard I walked away from money. They want to know how I did that. They want the golden key to unlock their golden handcuffs. No matter how much they earned, it was never quite enough to free them. Similar to the way ethical objections rarely triggered a change by themselves, having enough money to change rarely triggered the change by itself. It had to get personal. Something else had to pull the trigger. Going in, everyone thinks they'll be strong enough to resist the golden handcuffs and the glowing praise. I'll do this for just a few years. Wait, what about those Microsoft millionaires? Again, I found plenty who found something worthwhile to do after they made their money. But when they were 24 and starting at Microsoft, they didn't say to themselves, I really want to own a stonemason company and build marquee fireplaces with rare Italian rock. But that's going to cost a lot of money, so I'd better work here at Microsoft for 10 years. I met another who had always wanted to import exotic fabrics from southern India. She put some money into that dream and probably could have afforded to lose money on it for years, but she didn't respect it unless it existed on its own merits. She didn't want a hobby. Toy stores, organic farms, same thing. Okay, it happens. I know it does. Dream, lockbox, fuck you money, lockbox, dream. That cold, calculated formula? Rarer than I ever imagined. I'm not advocating giving up your day jobs to chase pipe dreams, but don't put your dreams in lockboxes and don't invest years of your life in a day job for the wad you expect to have at the end. Believe in that myth at your own peril. This next story is a fair example of how it really happens most of the time. Joe Olchevsky didn't lock his dream away, but he compromised it until it was almost forgotten. He made some money, but never as much as he might have thought he would. Eventually, he began to ache for meaning, haunted by the ghosts of what he could have been. he found his way back slowly. Getting there required both fortuitous circumstance and healing from an enormous loss.
Story 8. The Green Eyeshade.
The ceilings are low in Joel Chevsky's office. Sound tiles alternate with opaque fluorescent panels. The industrial-grade pebbled carpet hides a few stains. The big wood desk is standard issue, available in any supply catalog. Someone is collecting egg cartons in his lobby. When he cracks the Venetian blinds, the view captures the base of the Space Needle and the wavy rainbow roof of the Experience Music project. His office is in an old school at the base of Queen Anne Hill. The place reeks of plodding bureaucracy. The computers on desks are eyesores. Paper memos go out every morning announcing who's reserved the old classrooms as meeting rooms. This is his habitat, and he feels lucky to be here. On the first floor, then at the end of a hallway, his photograph is the last in line of the many men who have run this place. In his picture, which doesn't do him justice, he's a prematurely balding guy with a kind of jowly, bookwormy aura. The last kid to be picked for the baseball team. Caught here in his blazer and tie, he could be an accountant or a numbers cruncher of some sort, which he was for 12 years. In his picture, he looks 40 going on 60. But in person, he lights up and radiates an unexpected warmth. He's fit and moves with grace. The more time I spent with him, the younger and younger he seemed. For the record, he's 42. Joe would be the first to say that what I saw in the picture is the man he used to be, and what I saw in person is the man he's only recently become. He used to be cerebral, careful not to let his passions interfere with his decisions. Now he sees that passions are the great organizing force of the world. As a leader, he's found that to move a mass of people, you absolutely must connect with their emotions. Only a small slice of the world can be persuaded by passionless arguments. It is Joe's job to move the people because he was recently named the superintendent of the Seattle schools. In Seattle, he is nicknamed the accidental superintendent because he has no teaching experience and no government experience, and his appointment was not recommended by the search committee that scoured the country for qualified candidates. He did not spend his fortune on a campaign. He does not have a fortune. He did not have a campaign. A few years ago, he was another modest public finance investment banker who was trying not to forget that there was more to life. One night, he rocked his newborn daughter, India, to sleep and tucked his tired wife, Judy, into their bed. At 9 p.m., he went downstairs to their apartment tower's gym to clock a few miles on the treadmill, and in those unlikely surroundings, he bumped into the rest of his life. When Joe was a sophomore at the University of Chicago, he thought he wasn't interested in anything, which meant he'd probably end up at law school by default, trying to maintain respectability. He went to a career counselor who gave him some good, simple advice. Go out into the world and watch what you naturally pay attention to. This will reveal your interests. That summer, he went home to St. Paul, and he found he was really interested in the news stories about the progress of the first-term mayor, George Latimer. At the time, St. Paul's identity was still defined by an aristocratic class that descended from the railroad robber barons who made the city so glamorous in the early 1900s. The town was dying, and everyone but the aristocrats felt it. George Latimer was an unconventional politician, a short, fat, Lebanese man who spoke with a lisp and wanted to shake things up. He won over the populace and attracted a lot of new, young, dynamic people into government. That's all it was to Joe. Interest. Reading. Not a big deal, no epiphany, nothing like a call. But Cho changed his target from law school to Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. There he met Judy Bunnell, who became his wife. When they graduated in 1984, almost their entire class took high-paying jobs on Wall Street. They were abandoning their interest in government, but they didn't quite realize it at the time. They told themselves that it was for a few years, and that it was okay because they took jobs in public finance, which meant floating bonds for municipalities. They wouldn't work in government, but they'd work with government. And in that little semantic cheat, which seemed such a minor compromise at the time, most would never look back, would never return to the thing they really loved. Joe and his wife interviewed on Wall Street, but they didn't think their relationship could survive the intense Manhattan work and party schedule. They took the jobs they were offered on the condition that after training, they'd move out to their branch offices in the Twin Cities. It was an exciting time. Joe's firm, Piper Jaffray, was growing so fast that in 2 years he made vice president. He was only 28. Joe was called into his boss's office and told, "We want you to open a Seattle office." "I'm not sure Judy will leave her job," he said. "That's the other thing. You two are competing against each other here. She's winning business from you, and you from her. So that's what this is about." "Not at all. We want you to hire her and take her with you." Seattle was not yet the modern Seattle of Kurt Cobain, Starbucks, Amazon, and a Titanic Bill Gates. It was a frontier ready to be shaped. The next 5 years were the most enjoyable of Joe's life. The office grew to 9 bankers. Joe was a savvy manager. Investment bankers have big egos. They want each other's turf. Joe would tape a question of the week to his door and make it mandatory everyone participate. Name the top 3 funniest movies of all time. Or, if stranded on a desert island, what 3 things would you bring? He'd get 27 different answers, resulting in greater familiarity and respect among colleagues. In another game, Joe made them chart on a spectrum how liberal or conservative they thought everyone else in the office was. Then they'd find out how they were viewed by others. It was often shocking. They became more sensitive to the image they projected. Then Joe had everyone write down what they imagined everyone else would be doing in 5 years. Again, it helped them see they were on different paths and didn't need to fight. Joe was having such a good time that he never thought much about his interest in local politics. It was enough that he had the Port of Seattle as a client, and the port director's problems were his problems, her headaches his headaches. When she went on maternity leave, he stepped in and prevented the port from being taken advantage of by other bankers. He thought of himself as a midwife, helping his municipal clients through the difficult labor of serving the public. He was involved, but he was always able to walk away. But by the mid-90s, he had a nascent, inchoate feeling that he was treading water. He'd accomplished what he'd set out to accomplish. What was next? "Ultimately, I started to feel that I didn't want to be a high-priced midwife. I wanted to be a mother. It was never my deal. It was my client's deal. They were taking the risk. They were building hospitals and bridges and freeways, not me. I envied them for that." Joe wanted to be in the productive stages of his life. He felt like he'd been consuming for 35 years, consuming education, consuming training, consuming know-how, learning how deals work, learning how to manage, improving himself, but for what? When was he going to take what he had consumed and produce something of his own, take the risk, contribute to the world? Joe lived in the Pike Place Market. One night, he came home and got in the elevator. On the second floor, the door opened and in walked an older man with movie star looks and a charismatic presence. The man paused, looked Joe in the eye, and then thrust out his hand. "John Stanford," he said, like that meant something. Joe took his hand, thinking, "And who the hell is John Stanford?" They chatted briefly on the way up to the fourth floor. Joe got enough to figure out that Stanford had recently been hired away from the Atlantic schools to run the Seattle system, whose previous superintendent had just been fired. Stanford was brand new in town, had moved into the building, and didn't know anyone. His job didn't start for another month. Joe continued to bump into Stanford at the gym late at night. The two had an affinity from the beginning. They often talked until 2 in the morning. Stanford was a retired Army Major General and talked to Joe a lot about leadership. One night, as the two were sweating it out on side-by-side stair climbers, Stanford said that all but one of his staff positions would be filled by staff from the previous administration. But that one position was the CFO. Would Joe come help him turn this district around? It was a complete surprise, but in a heartbeat, Joe said, "Sure." "Even though your daughter had just been born?" I asked Joe. "I know. That would usually not be a time to take a risk. But I didn't overthink it. It popped out, surprised even me. I hadn't been angling for a position. But as soon as he offered it, I knew I wanted it." I asked, "Had you ever done a bond deal for the school district? Did you know much about them?" I would occasionally meet with other local bankers, and we'd swap horror stories, he said. Seattle Schools was the worst client anyone could have. It would take five elections to pass one levy. The schools were in such bad shape that the public didn't want to throw good money after bad. The public didn't trust the district with a penny. There had been a huge flight to the private schools. Every parent in Seattle was aware how bad it was. And that didn't stop you? I asked. It was John Stanford. John made the impossible seem possible. He was really a great man. The first month, Joe and John drove over to a community hearing in the Magnolia District, where members of the public got a chance to speak their minds. They didn't know if anyone would show up. It was in a tiny elementary school cafeteria. When they walked in, the room was packed with 250 people. All three local TV stations had cameras set up, as did CNN and NewsHour. Joe and John listened for 2.5 hours. John Stanford captured that pent-up hope and channeled it to break the bureaucracy's stranglehold on the district. He implemented a market-based school system where the dollars were attached to each pupil, not to each school, and the students were free to choose their public school. As students moved around, the dollars went with them. There was so much resistance from within, but there was such a yearning in the heart of the public and on the school board to get serious about change. The catch was, 6 weeks into the job, Joe discovered that the previous superintendent had pushed costs into the future, and the district was 18 months from bankruptcy. Joe had to cut $35 million from the $350 million budget, even as Stanford was promising money for his new initiatives. The CFO and the superintendent became Mr. Inside, Mr. Outside, the prophet of doom and the prophet of hope. At this point, Joe's public image was that of a bloodless green eye shade, and some of it was deserved. Joe's notion of civil service was that he, as a private sector financier, brought his smarts and his can-do to help the public sector out. But when he put on those airs, he would insult people to the point that they would never work with him. His private sector pedigree was meaningless to the entrenched civil workers in permanent government. Joe said, "If you act like the private sector is better, you're dead." John Stanford stuck by him, and the two men grew close. Stanford was 20 years older. Joe's own father had died when Joe was 23. Joe's father had been a foreman at a natural gas plant. Stanford was one of the only men Joe has ever seen as a role model. On March 30, 1998, John Stanford went to the doctor for some tests, and by the next day he knew he would soon die. He had AML, leukemia. Joe went to the Barnes & Noble in the U Village and looked up AML in a physician's handbook. Acute myelogenous leukemia is a particularly painful type of leukemia, and less than 10% survive. They both felt the only chance Stanford had to survive was to not accept his death and fight, so Joe went over to the hospital all the time, and they talked about what they would accomplish together when Stanford came back to work. His first round of chemo failed. Though nobody thought it would really help, Stanford underwent a bone marrow transplant to create a public perception that he was really fighting for his life. The whole city rooted for him. When Stanford died in November, it was one of the great community crises in the city's history. The city memorialized him for 2 weeks straight. The memorial service was held at Heck Edmondson Pavilion, which was packed with 10,000 grieving people. This two-hour service was carried commercial-free during prime time on the local television channels, and it was one of the highest-rated nights of television ever. Joe Olchevsky was the MC of the service, and as the entire city's eyes were upon him, they did not want to hear the bloodless green eyeshade who had balanced the budget. They needed Joe to echo the sadness in their hearts. I've watched the videotape, and what I see reminds me of that moment in How the Grinch Stole Christmas, when the Grinch hears the singing in Whoville and suddenly grows a heart. Joe Olchevsky cracked open, and fading into his past were the balance sheets that made order out of the unruly chaos of public service. Rising up was an understanding that the world is ruled by our hearts, and that his own actions would be ruled by his own heart. Joe told me, "I always believed that I would never realize the limits of my own bandwidth. I didn't realize how different that is when your heart is heavy. It humbled me. That whole next year humbled me. It taxed me so much emotionally and physically until I couldn't give any more. Everywhere I went, everywhere I spoke, people needed more from me. I hit the limits of my capabilities every day. For the first time in my life, I had to admit I was powerless, but I still had to move on. The memorial at Heck Ed was followed by a burial at Arlington National Cemetery because Stanford was a major general. Joe had never been more moved. The uniforms, the horse-drawn casket, the head of the U.S. Army kneeling in the mud, folding up the American flag to put it in the casket, the 21-gun salute, cannons firing into the air. The Army prepares for death, so it's a really big deal to them if you're someone's successor. They treated Joe with great respect and sat him next to Colin Powell. But Joe's position as successor was not at all certain when he got back to Seattle, not in the minds of the school board, and not in Joe's. A board meeting was scheduled for a month later, and he did not talk to the board during that time. Every other crossroads in Joe's life had been a career choice. This time it was entirely an emotional choice. Only one question mattered. How do I best deal with my grief? For 10 months, every conversation with Stanford had been about the time when he'd come back to work. That was to be the payoff for the agony of watching him suffer. After his death, for the first few weeks, Joe was certain that he couldn't heal in the superintendent's office. He had to get past it, move on in life. Maybe it was time to go back to banking. He had given his 3 years of service, go back to private life, grieve in private. As an Irish Catholic, he'd been raised with eternal guiding principles that floated above his everyday life. When important decisions had to be made, the question was not, what are your principles, but which principles are you prepared to act on? Act was the operative word. Joe needed not to withdraw, but to act. The best way to deal with his grief was to carry Stanford's agenda forward, keep enacting the change Stanford started. He told the school board he was ready to ascend to the superintendency, but they were not ready for it. He even had LASIK surgery to get rid of his glasses, but they weren't impressed. Joe had never been a teacher. He did not represent the racial diversity of the district. He was a numbers nut. He was going to fire some principals and piss teachers off. A banker should not be running the schools. They wanted John Stanford back. John Stanford was a saint. Joe Olcheski was only human. They debated for 3 months until they finally gave Joe the nod. I found Joe's transformation inspiring. That he was not a saint, that he was merely human, is what led me to him. At one point, he wondered aloud, "Where is my generation? Why is my generation not with me?" It's not easy to answer, but I think there's something in whether one's motivation comes from the mind or the heart. The latter is willing to put up with a lot of crap and discord the former will avoid. The intellectually motivated person might read Joe's story while secretly thinking, "That'd be a cool job, but how much crap does he have to put up with?" I considered writing about the bureaucrat he has to fight. I was going to take a few crapometer measurements throughout Joe's day. But why indulge that question? The right question is not, "What's the crap factor?" The right question is, "How can I find something that moves my heart so that the inevitable crap storm is bearable?" Lately, I've found myself talking about what I call the brilliant masses. The brilliant masses are composed of nothing less than the many great people of our generation, the bright, the talented, the intelligent, the resourceful, the creative, far too many of whom are operating at quarter speed, unsure of their place in the world, contributing far too little to the productive engine of modern civilization, still feeling like observers, all feeling like they haven't come close to living up to their potential. The brilliant masses are mostly intellectually motivated, so if they cross over and get involved, their commitment is conditioned on being respected, and conditioned on a minimum of unnecessary idiocy, and conditioned on winning and succeeding. They like being cerebral. In their tribes, it's cool. Being guided by the heart is almost never something an intellectually motivated person chooses to do. It's something that happens to them. usually something painful. Joe chose to assist John Stanford when Joe was still intellectually inspired, but he didn't commit to the district until John Stanford and John's death had changed him. So where is his generation? Waiting for the pain that opens up its heart.